And this is the Sandspur Hour. Wish you good morning.
Good morning, guys. Good morning, Rollins College and Winter Park area.
My name is Greg Golden.
My name is Amir Sadeh.
And for the next hour, we'll be talking about some local goings-ons at Rollins College.
Fun stuffs.
As we are representing the Sandspur student newspaper here at Rollins College. And in today's show, we'll be playing our interview with Dr. David Charles, director of the upcoming production in the Annie Russell Theater, Anna in the Tropics. We'll then be speaking to head dramaturg Dr. Jen Scott Mobley and
SM, studio manager?
Yes, the
stage manager.
The stage part escaped me for a second. Stage manager Alexa Gordon. And after that, we'll be playing our conversation with Scott Novak and Matt Hendry about their article in the most recent issue about gun control. And then after that, at 9:50, you'll want to find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesandspur, where we'll be having a trivia question where the first person to answer correctly will be winning a $5 gift card to Gertzberry.
Wow. $5.
Yes. So we are going to get right to it and play our interview with Dr. David Charles. Dr. David Charles is the chair of the Rollins Department of Theater and Dance, creative director of the Rollins Improv Players, and producing director of the Annie Russell Theater. His credits on that stage include creating and directing the improvised shows Murder, We Wrote and It's All Greek to Me, directing Doubt, and now directing the theater department's latest production, Anna in the Tropics, opening February 8th. Why was this show selected for this season?
That's a great question. When we're selecting our seasons, we look to meet the needs of our audiences, of our students, and also to develop the community that we're in. And so this show, for me, was a risk. It deals with primarily Cuban-American immigrants. We don't have a large section of that populace in our student body to cast, and so that made me a little nervous. But something I often teach in the classroom is running towards fear, and I want our seasons to be more diversified. So it's like, okay, I hope if I build it, they will come, and we can get a cast that sort of reflects the diversity of the Florida region. And I think that's happened, and it's been very exciting. It's also a somewhat, quote-unquote, local playwright. Also an award-winning play to won the Pulitzer. So for all of those reasons, I was like, this is a good play and is worthy to be seen.
Dr. Charles, the cast and crew visited the setting of the play Ybor City just a few weeks ago as an intercession course. How did that experience influence the production?
There is something neat and educational, but I'll use the word neat, about being able to access what you're actually doing on the stage. So to go down and see the huge open skies, to visit a cigar factory that's now a Scientology museum, to watch someone live roll a cigar in the traditional method, all of those things might seem small, but the sum total of them is huge. In addition to its created this amazing ensemble with the company. We've had these common experiences. We watched Anna Karenina, the movie, to give a sense of the Russian part of the play as well. And so I've really enjoyed working in that aspect and with a dramaturgy team, which is unusual for our productions as well. I have a colleague, Dr. Jen Scott Mobley, and two student assistant dramaturgs who are helping to flesh out the historical component of the show, which again, that's great. I love that stuff, but it's often hard to dedicate the kind of time you'd like to as a director or as a company to that material when you're trying to get a show staged and rehearsed in 3.5 weeks.
You talked about how the audience of the show will influence the choosing of the play. Mm-hmm. What specifically about the Winter Park community do you think was a thought that you developed in your choice?
I think I want the play, I was saying in a rehearsal, it's like a play selection or a play itself should almost be a gumbo, right? You want all these different ingredients that create an interesting offering to your audience. And so I hope that this will appeal to multiple demographics in our audience. I hope the students will be intrigued by this lost period in time. It's set in 1929 with the tradition of hand-rolled cigars, which is something I knew nothing about, let alone that Ybor City was literally the cigar capital of the entire entire world, that so many cigars have been hand-rolled in that one city. These are the little facts that, you know, as a foreigner myself, I didn't know. So there is an unavoidably delicious local flavour to it. And then it's challenging material. It's well-written, challenging material. And one always hopes that when you go to the theatre, you'll be entertained, but perhaps you'll leave thinking about something or learning something. And I think this play has multiple opportunities for an audience in that regard as well. So we just want people to come, enjoy themselves, think about what life was like back in 1929 and some of these very provocative themes that run through the piece.
Did you, as a director, feel you needed to do anything either to the script or technique-wise in order to make the characters more accessible to your actors?
Oh, that's the director's task, I think, for most shows. So most of these characters are in their 30s or 40s or beyond. So just dealing with a cast where I think my oldest cast member is Michael Galace. Sorry, Mike. so most of them are in their, you know, teenage years or early 20s. So you have that leap. Then you have the culture leap. We have a very diverse cast, but as fate would have it, we actually don't have any Cuban Americans in the cast. We have several Latino and Latina actresses, but no one from that particular area. So there's the cultural barriers as well. So that was part of what Intercession you were talking about earlier, that was designed to give us some insight to that. But as you know, no culture can be summarised or fully experienced in a couple of days. And then we've tried through the use of music, through the use of movement, and then the play itself is this beautiful document, this beautiful research resource that provides all of these lovely details about what life was like back then. Well, one of the little things that we've uncovered is this was actually the act of rolling cigars was a relatively gender-neutral profession. Women were paid the same as men, which was very peculiar for America or for anywhere in the world at that time. So there are these fun little anomalies and social peculiarities that have been real joyful to explore.
You have a lot of work in both improv and scripted theater, and do any similarities exist between how actors find their characters in scripted theater and in improv?
Oh, that's, yeah, you have good questions. And I have long answers. Sorry, listeners. yes, there are similarities. I think a lot of it is a fearlessness. An improv character and a scripted character, for me, both start rooted in yourself. Even if you're playing a matriarch who's 50 years old or the owner of a cigar factory, you've got to start with something that's true for you and sort of add the layers. Obviously, the script gives you the benefit of revision and time. You're not making a snap choice that you have to follow through as you would in improv. But like improv, I want an audience to come and feel that these lines have been said for the very first time. So you have to create that reactivity and sense of spontaneity. So they're complementary worlds, but they are tough worlds to put together. I find that's perhaps my journey now as a director of how do I bring the freedom I love in improv to the scripted work? How do I bring the structure and polish of scripted work to my improv work?
How would you describe the experience of planning and preparing the show while simultaneously preparing for the birth of your first child?
Wow, that's the one I should have read ahead of time. That would be a better question for my wife, who I've not seen for approximately 3 weeks. That's tough. That's tough. I think maybe in a strangely good way, it has sensitized me and opened me emotionally. So it can be hard to be in a rehearsal till 10, 10:30 and you've not seen your newborn for 3 days, which that was this week for me. So it makes me commit to the work in a different way because I'm giving up quite a lot to be doing it. But it's not an easy balance, and it's not one I've found. Hopefully Cooper is too young to remember his absent father during his fourth month of life. So that is an interesting and ongoing struggle that all of us in the arts have to face. You know, how do we balance creating vibrant work about our lives with lives, you know? Any suggestions, gentlemen?
I guess one final thing to ask. What do you hope at the end of this process, not only be the students in your audience, but also students who are in the tech and the cast, what do you hope that they get out of this production, out of this experience?
Much of that comes down to ensemble for me, Amir, in the biggest sense. I think a good show creates a special ensemble between the cast and the crew and the production team. And a really good production actually extends that ensemble through the fourth wall into the audience, so that for those 2 hours or hour 45, you felt like you were a part of something a little special. And that for me, I hope, is what live theatre will always do in a slightly different way than film or TV, that you're sharing common time and common breath with a community. You're seeing a production that even a scripted production is going to be a little different every single night based on the audience that's present and who forgets their line on that particular night. So I hope that this can be, you know, one of many opportunities in our season at the Annie to build and celebrate that sense of ensemble, community, and togetherness.
All right, thank you. And we wish you good luck in this upcoming performance.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
We're now in studio with Dr. Jen Scott Mobley and Alexa Gordon of the production Anna in the Tropics. And if you could start out just giving us a synopsis of the play, what our audience might want to know going in.
Okay, I'll take this one. Feel free to jump
in,
Alexa.
I'll chime in, of course.
The play is set in 1929 in Ybor City, Tampa, Florida. And it revolves around a family at a cigar factory. And what happens when a new lector comes into town to read for them. And it's a lector is a tradition in which that still exists in Cuban cigar factories today, but sort of died out after the stock market crash. But the tradition of reading aloud to the workers while they did their manual labor all day long. So a new lector arrives, and his presence impacts everyone who works in the factory in different ways. Do you want to add to that, Alexa?
Oh, sure. Well, the lector in this particular play, Juan Julian, played by Zach Zabrowski, comes to the factory to read Anna Karenina by Tolstoy. So that's where the Anna comes from in Anna in the Tropics.
Oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah.
And so just as a little refresher for our audience and perhaps our hosts, what does the dramaturgical team do? What does that consist of?
It's not a refresher. I don't think anybody knows what dramaturgy is. People think of it as a horrible disease. Dramaturgy is a practice that in which people work to research and uphold the integrity of older scripts and or research and illuminate classic texts or help develop new scripts. So in a play like Anna in the Tropics, which is set in a previous time period, what we do is get all that research, all the terms, all the geographic locations, all the history that's implied in the play but perhaps not explicit. And if you're an actor, you might not be familiar with, for example, who Jose Marti is. And the characters, of course, reference that. So all those little points we help research so that it's available for the director and the cast to understand the play more fully. And then we also work on sometimes on outreach, marketing and outreach, and offering sort of aesthetic advice to the director as he works through, or her, she works through the process.
And have you had any experience like the one that you had in taking your actors to the location of the play?
No, I can honestly say I've never been so fortunate as to be a dramaturg on a play where the resource was so close. As a dramaturg, I've sometimes gone someplace and just myself to do the research and taken pictures and brought all that back. And that's one thing. But to be able to take the cast and crew, you know, to the well, so to speak, was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it was a great experience for the cast and crew to get down to the Ybor City Museum and see the cigar factories as they stand today and just learn a lot about the history and to really walk in those streets, which we're trying to put up in the Annie, was, I think, really rewarding and exciting for all of us because no one had ever done that before. It wasn't available, so it was great. Yeah, it was fun.
What excites you about a show like this?
Oh, me?
Either.
I think I've been just excited by this whole process because as a graduating senior, moving on and just the material and seeing, you know, my friends really dive headfirst into something that was different for us culturally. And I think, as you heard in the interview with Dr. D, our department doesn't have a lot of cultural representation. So it was really, really great through the audition process and everything to have such a wide representation. We have so many nationalities represented in the cast, from Thailand to the Bahamas to Greece, so all kinds of people working on the show. So it's just been a great melting pot kind of experience to, you know, really bring something a little bit different than I think most of the audiences are used to.
Alexa, as a stage manager, how do you facilitate the relationship between the vision of the director and the interpretation of the actors?
That's actually one of the reasons I wanted to work on this particular project as my capstone project, because I've known Dr. D for about 3 years now, and we have a really great working relationship through Rollins Improv Players and, you know, academia. So it's really easy for us to communicate in rehearsals and, you know, kind of throw ideas back and forth between the actors. So really it's just my job to make sure when Dr. D steps out and when the show goes up this Friday that I'm carrying out his vision and making sure that all of the decisions he made in terms of blocking and, you know, all those decisions, the creative decisions that get made along the way are just carried out fully.
How is stage managing the show comparable to your previous theater experiences over the last 4 years?
Over the last 4 years, I love working with smaller casts, and this is great because it's an ensemble of 12 people, so it's great to give people a lot of personal attention, and we're also very lucky to have students in this performance. It's their first performance on the Annie or their first performance ever. So it's been really great for me to... I just wanted to give them a really great first experience and to welcome them into the Annie family. And, you know, I think Dr. D does a great job of encouraging that in rehearsal. Just, you know, being playful and having a lot of fun and getting the work done when it needs to be.
And, of course, we know Dr. D to be a fun guy from his appearances on stage, SAC, Rollins Improv Players. What's been the most fun moment, the most memorable moment so far in production?
Gosh, the most memorable moment. Do you have one?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it fun, but but I would say Dr. D being terribly fun and breaking the ice was our Cuban dancing lessons.
Oh, yes.
Which
I have
which
removed
even,
that from memory.
Yes, well, even I partook of, and I have 4 left feet, I think. But, you know, the dramaturgs, crew, everybody who was at that rehearsal tried to learn a few moves, and I think Dr. D... cut a rug in such a way as to make it really fun for everybody.
Yeah.
And some of us are really good dancers. Not me, but...
but the cast, they're great.
Great. And what are the show times for this production?
Well, we open this Friday, which is February 8th at 8 o'clock, and then we will also run through the 16th, and we have a Sunday matinee performance. I believe that's the 10th at 4 p.m.
Yes.
And then...
followed by a talk back.
Oh, yes, followed by a talk back. Jen, Scott, do you want to
jump
in there?
Yeah, we're trying to... we're hoping... to have people stay a few minutes after the show to respond to the show. And we have some guest panelists from the Modern Language Department, Dr. Baraneche, Dr. Tomai, and Nelson Betancourt, who's the executive director of the Olaw Festival. They're coming. They're going to see the show and offer different perspectives on Cuban-American immigrant experience, as well as respond to the show and take questions. So that'll be after the matinee on the 10th.
And we run until February 16th.
Great. And where can someone find out that information online?
www.rollins.edu/AnnieRussell.
And it's important to note that Rollins students get in with their R card.
Yes. All you got to do is bring your R card to the box office window.
I just want to thank you guys both for coming in the studio, talking about the show. It means a lot, and I really hope the run is very successful.
Thanks, thank Amir. You. Thanks, sure Greg.
Thanks. And Matt Hendry and Scott Novak shared their opinions about gun control in the most recent issue of the Sans Spur. We had a conversation with them to find their stance on specific aspects of the current gun debate. They begin by providing the personal stances that they provided in their articles, and you'll first hear Scott.
So my argument basically stated that, well, I believe people do have a right to access guns. There should come, I guess, a boundary between exactly who has access to these guns. And I think we need to, just like when you have a car, you can't just walk in and get a car. I think it should be the same way with guns. While I do believe you have a right to own a gun, I don't think you should just be able to just walk into a gun shop or a gun fair and just get a gun. I do believe in background checks. I do believe that certain higher power guns, assault rifles, for example, I'm all for handguns, but just because of the damage that they can inflict, if you're not serving in the military, what do you really need a gun of that power capacity for? I don't really see any justifiable reason besides for sport, which I don't think is a good enough reason given the immense harm that they've inflicted throughout the years. So that's basically the crux of my argument in a nutshell.
And Matt, how about yours?
I did the con article for the gun control issue, and pretty much the crux of my argument was just talking about how it's a constitutional right and how the Second Amendment pretty much guarantees the freedom right to bear arms. And then it also talked a little bit about how restricting guns and gun control doesn't really do anything to reduce crime, as we've seen in certain areas like Washington, D.C., Chicago, and New York. And then that was pretty much the whole argument there.
Matt, to you first. Referring to your article, can a gun give a good person the agency to do something bad?
I would say no. Not as more as a car would or a knife or anything like that. Pretty much the fact of the matter is owning a gun's not going to make a good person a bad person. If that was the case, then there would be millions more deaths every year because of all the gun owners. So I would say no to that question.
Okay. Scott, what do you do you have anything to comment on that question?
Yes. I would say while it is true that the majority of guns are used safely, guns do increase, I guess I would say, the risk of something bad happening, the risk of conflict. For example, I can't remember the exact statistics. They're not sitting in front of me right now. But having a gun in your household at least doubles your risk of having some sort of gun-related death. I mean, that's striking. And now, granted, it's not always in gun safety, we're not always talking about, you know, mass murders, like coming in and shooting everyone. It's just like, you know, a lot of accidents happen around guns. Or if you're contemplating suicide and you own a gun, you're much more likely to kill yourself if you're a gun owner than if you aren't. I mean, that's one of the big statistics from the American Psychological Association. So,
may I respond?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I would say, as far as the suicide issue goes, I don't see any trend that a gun would make someone more likely to commit suicide. If they didn't have a gun, there's numerous ways to do that, and I know, you know, suicide is a terrible topic to talk about. But going back to as far as guns increasing crime, there's no actual statistic out there for the crimes that don't happen because of a person owning a gun. For example, concealed carry permits in states that have them, and compared to states that don't.
Professional football.
You can see there's no trend to which is more harm than good. So concealed carry permits and guns legally owned, I believe, reduce crime.
But while it is true, we don't have a lot of firm research on this topic. And even causation is very hard to prove. And I remember reading in your article, you were saying, like, these cities have gun restrictions, right, yet they still have really high crime rates.
They do.
I mean, even that, like, causation, though, is hard to prove because a lot goes into crime besides just access to guns. You know, there's, like, issues of poverty, education.
Right.
So to me, it's more like a matter of common sense. Like, that's, I mean, your argument is like saying, with the environment, like, we still have huge problems with the environment, and endangered species are still endangered. So that's like saying, well, obviously, the Environmental Protection Act's not working, so we should get rid of that. So that's kind of like what your argument was sounding like, just because, like, well, obviously, to, you know, commit crimes, guns are needed, so why not at least enact at least a few minimal gun safety laws. We're not going to, like, take your guns away from you, but just, like, background checks, for example, that's something that, like, I would hope at least, like, both sides of this debate
right.
could agree on.
And I never said anything against background checks. We're on the same page there.
Okay.
What I would say as far as acts or criminals, crimes being committed, more often than not, the ones committing the crimes are criminals, and no matter what, they are going to find a way to get guns.
Mm-hmm.
So these restrictions, the only thing that it's pretty much affecting is law-abiding citizens.
Mm-hmm.
That's my concern.
Yeah,
because
I definitely agree with you there.
How I see the whole issue of, say, guns, whatever, is guns is what some people would call the great equalizer. It allows a 100-pound woman to be able to protect herself from a 250-pound man or a retired veteran from against a gang member. It's my belief that it's better to own a gun if that's your choice, because the Constitution allows that for citizens. For you to legally own a gun and not have to use it, than for you to need it and not have it. That's my belief.
Okay. Scott, this question is directed to you. In your article, you mentioned the AR-15, which is very well known, was one of the weapons used in the most recent shooting. Technically, though, it's not listed as an assault weapon.
Yeah.
And previous reasons, its restriction under the assault weapons ban hasn't been because it's an assault weapon, but certain modifications. So technically,
yeah.
It is legal. What would you say is an assault weapon, or I guess better put, what weapons should be listed under a ban than what we previously had in 1994?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, with AR-15, that's I believe it's a semi-automatic. I'm not like a gun expert on these things, but so I think there's a difference between, although technically yes, it's not an assault rifle per se, as in like the strict definition. But I do still, like you said, I do believe it should be listed, and since it was listed under the previous assault rifles ban, just for under certain modifications, it can do a severe amount of damage. So I would list any guns that can inflict a serious amount of harm on a lot of people in a matter of, you know, seconds even, should be under that ban. I think because the Second Amendment technically is like the right to bear arms, so I think a large part of the gun safety argument is where do you draw the, like, obviously we don't give our citizens bazookas, yet bazookas are a still type, you know, that's an arm. So technically you could make a successful legal argument that I have a right to own a bazooka or a nuke because I have the right to bear arms. It says so in the Second Amendment. So I think the real debate here is on how, not even like how do we interpret like to bear arms, because technically all these things are arms. It's like where are we drawing the line on which arms citizens can own?
May I respond?
Of course.
So I just want to talk a little bit about the difference between an automatic and semi-automatic. Right now, it is illegal for citizens to own any kind of automatic weapon. So there are no legal guns on the market where you hold the trigger and it just sprays. The semi-automatic means that every time you pull the trigger, a bullet comes out. Now, that's what the AR-15 does. But the other guns that also do that are revolvers, handguns, shotguns, rifles. They all do the same thing. So why aren't those being considered banned? According to the U.S. Department of Defense, the weapons that were banned under the last assault weapons ban, they were responsible for less than 2% of the crimes committed. So it's my argument, why is this specific gun, not that I'm a fan of the AR-15, I'm just saying, why are we picking and choosing certain weapons because they might look more scary compared to a handgun, which statistic for statistic is way up there, almost quadruple used in crimes. Why isn't that being talked about?
Very true.
Definitely. Well, can I respond to that
real
quick?
Yeah, of course.
One thing to add with that. I mean, you're right, and I definitely agree with you when you said, like, these gun laws, their effects in practice would be, they'd have very minimal effects, I guess, just because they're hard to implement. So many people already have guns, no matter, like, what type. I mean, they're already out there, so it's not like you can just, like, pull them back in, and I wouldn't even agree with taking guns away from everyone. So it just, I think we also need to have better dialogues about, I guess, like, poverty, how we handle the mentally ill, because
absolutely.
I think, like, over, at least over 20% of the people who are in prison have some sort of mental illness, and at least, I mean, it's probably much higher than that. I forget where I read that. I wish I could have a source for that. But, yeah, so I think it just, unfortunately, we do get a lot, well, politicians, not we, I guess, get really distracted and just focusing on the gun measures, and they're kind of like, because that's the easy thing to me. That's the easy thing to talk about, because it's easy to have a side, one side or the other. But then with all these other issues, there's so many, like, unknowns and so much research that we have to do.
And also the thing is that more murders are committed with just your fists, knives, baseball bats, cars, like, all these things. So for me, it's not really an issue about guns. I agree with you that mental health is definitely an area where we should be putting resources, and both sides should be working towards that. But at least the way I'm viewing this, these measures, precautionary measures for gun control, it's more of just a political thing. I don't really see it having any sort of significant effect, because as we've seen, gun control really doesn't reduce crime, because the criminals or whoever are committing these crimes, they will always find a way to have a gun. So the only people that this is affecting are the law-abiding citizens.
Well, and this leads to a question that I would, obviously it's for both of you. What policy changes, if any, do you think should be made?
Is this in regard to school shootings or just gun control in general?
Gun control in general. And either one of you can take it, start up the first.
As far as dealing with school shootings, I think that administrators, at least security guards and teachers, should be armed if they choose to do so. And I think the government and the school district, they need to go through safety training and actually proper ways to know how to operate a firearm, because that's one thing that I'm sure we can all agree on, that there's nothing more dangerous than someone using a gun that doesn't know how to carefully and responsibly use one. So I think that's a measure that could be taken as far as to protect school shootings or whatnot. As far as the whole issue of, you know, gun violence, I think we need to enforce the laws that are already on the books, because right now there's background checks. Nobody can just walk into a gun store and purchase a gun. That doesn't happen. So we need to enforce those laws that are on the books, and I just think that we need to go after the criminals. This needs to be about the justice system.
I would also say, definitely with the gun training, just like, I think that should be not just for teachers and, like, I think that should be for everyone. Like, if you're going to get a gun, you should be trained on how to use it. And I think that will help prevent, like, a lot of the accidents, like we were talking about earlier before. So I think that's an excellent idea. And as far as what the Obama administration has done, some of it's kind of, I guess, fuzzy and has yet to take concrete form, like his executive orders. For example, they haven't had time to become concrete, I guess. But as far as, like, I like the idea of having, again, like, trying to find better ways to enforce the system of background checks. I think part of his, like, executive orders was providing incentives for states to comply with the background check system. But then, of course, the question is, so what? How are you going to do that? What incentive? So that would be, we're still kind of in the dark about that. And then kind of moving away, I guess, to more, like, from the gun aspect to the overall like the mental health issues we're talking about, he definitely included that in his plan, which I think is very important. And I hope that we will have a serious discussion about mental health and some actual action produced from that discussion. Unfortunately, what sometimes tends to happen in politics is that they do like months-long studies that last like 6 months or a year, and by the time like they've done the study, everyone's forgotten about the issue and doesn't care anymore. So I hope that that will not happen in the political field with this issue.
Just another fact it's just a sad talking point, but all of these executive orders, I believe there's 23,
yeah.
I don't see that how any of them would have had a direct impact to prevent Sandy Hook. I agree, we need to look at the mental health issue, but I don't believe that executive orders overstepping the Constitution is the way to do so. If there's going to be legislation passed or whatever, then that's a different talking point. But regardless of the president, I don't agree with executive orders.
Well, I don't think executive orders are overstepping the Constitution. I mean, the president has the power to make executive orders because he is the president. But, I mean, Obama himself has said for any real change to come about, Congress needs to do something. What they do exactly, I mean, that's where the real power here lies, Congress. So.
Okay, great. Thank you guys so much. I think this was a good dialogue to have. It's great to see that have obviously two sides coming together and having a conversation, a real substantive conversation on the issue. Obviously, that there'll be points of difference, but to also see points of concurrence and agreement is important, and it's key to moving forward. Again, thank you so much from me, myself, and Greg Golden and the Stance per Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again to Matt and Scott. Their articles may be found by the name Are Gun Rights Out of Control on thesandspur.org. And now for sports. So there were some sports last night.
Sports have happened. Yes, tons and tons of sports.
The big one was there was a bowl, and it was very super.
Word on the street. So, sports aside, of course, the Super Bowl has a tremendous amount of public appeal.
I mean, it's not just two teams vying for that championship, but there's also a lot of other pomp and circumstance that have occurred.
And while we can talk about what really everyone else is talking about in terms of the numbers, the statistics, we'll get into some of them. But just starting out, what is your reason for watching the Super Bowl, Amir?
I'll be honest, you know, I think it's like one of those things you have to watch sometimes. You know, it's like the Grammys or like the Oscars. You watch the Super Bowl. The one substantive thing that I do enjoy, because I will admit I'm not very big on the actual football, I enjoy the commercials.
Yeah. And so how did these years' commercials rank to years past?
They were very hit and miss. Word on the street again was the GoDaddy commercial. Again,
sure.
they had a somewhat, I wouldn't say controversial, but they had a very interesting commercial where they somewhat shied away from just having the pretty lady come on. But I don't know if you saw it.
Oh yeah, I did. That's why I'm making the face I'm making.
Yes. Oh yeah. Again, viewers, somewhat grimacing. If you did not see the Super Bowl, you haven't seen this commercial. It is kind of talking about how it mixes sexy with smart. And it culminates to a beautiful supermodel making out with somewhat, I guess you would call, nerdy individual. But it isn't even that. It is the added sound effects of the slurping that you would... That's just what adds the cringeworthy factor. And it's somewhat what GoDaddy does. It goes for the controversy. It goes for the throat. But that just definitely was not...
They were going for the throat, all right.
Yeah, that just was not the most enjoyable thing to watch. I will say, though...
Like, who's the Foley artist on that one?
I will say that the M&M's commercial, was very cool, kind of a la
Meatloaf.
Doesn't
ring a bell.
There was the Red M&M was singing I Do Anything for Love, and kind of going through that montage of like, cutesiness with, I can't remember the girl's name. She's in Glee.
Okay. Guaranteeing that I don't know who it is.
Yes. And then near the end, she gets more, like, it isn't, like, infatuated. Like, it's like, oh, cute. It's like she's trying to eat him. And then at the end, he's, like, he's singing the song, and he's, like, under the piano, like, in a fetal position. So that was cute. Coke always does really cool ads and stuff. And, again, this was another really, really touching year for Coke. So those were definitely some of the highlights. I know... always people watch, there's always a theory that people watch, like there are three big commercials. There's like, you know, Bud, there's a celebrity endorsement, and then there's like, you know, Doritos or
something
there's
wacky.
Some wacky, like, or GoDaddy, like there's something like, you know, and definitely this year's Super Bowl definitely did not disappoint on that end. So yeah, commercials were all right. You know, some of them were hits and again, some of them were misses, but overall good year.
Who would have thought we would see the day when Psy would sell out?
I saw the pistachio one.
I mean, I envy the suit.
Right?
As
a fan,
mint green suit.
As a fan of Zoot Suits myself, who actually owns a all-white Zoot Suit, green jacket, and baby blue Zoot Suit, I was kind of like, I need that in my arsenal of my wardrobes.
Yes.
So I definitely appreciated rocking out that mint green Zoot Suit.
Yeah. Move over Master's jacket. We have a new green jacket of our fancy.
Yes.
Fancy, huh?
Sexy lady.
So, there were some interesting facts about this game. I don't know if you knew, but the coaches.
Brothers.
Were related.
Yes.
By blood.
By blood. I mean, it was crazy to kind of, you know, think about. I would hate to be their father. You know, the week before, this, like, it's like, you know, it must be like a very intense standoff. It's like, I love both my sons, but one of them is going to win this. And I don't know how to treat the situation.
Yeah. And that's tough. And there was a nice moment at the end where you could tell that there was an extended sort of meeting between the two brothers, whereas usually the coaches will kind of just shake hands and move on sort of thing. And so... some of the more interesting moments of that came when they would show them in split screen and you'd see Jim, the 49ers head coach, hopping around and grimacing, and John, the somewhat level-headed one, just showing mild disappointed where applicable, mild joy when the moment called for it. But
it was a really great game. It had its roller coaster moments, though. I will not lie. I mean, it seemed if you watched just the first half, you would think the Ravens just had it cinched. Beyonce was doing her dance and whatnot. We'll get to that soon. But then all of a sudden, lights go out right after the first play in the third quarter, and it's just 30 minutes where people are just kind of like, "What do we do?"
Yeah, and a few plays in for semantics.
Say, but
very close. You're right. But we even had at my Super Bowl party some insight by my future sister-in-law who works for Ring Power, which is a company that will provide lighting, well, in terms of generator power and such things for huge events. Her company worked on last year's Super Bowl.
Wow.
And said that they chose not to have a generator this year.
Why?
They were going green.
Oh, well, that tends to happen when you go green. I mean, things just decide not to work. I think the crazy thing is some people have argued, and some people would argue, I feel, if the 49ers did win, that it was like, oh, well, you know, that's because the generators went out, and when you're in the game, it's like a stopping of the momentum, like, you know, like that's not fair, you know, and but I think also it's you know, things like that happen. You really can't, you know, foresee, like, oh, a semicircle of the lights are just going to turn off magically, you know.
Yeah, I felt like the game then became the domain of real football fans again, as most people probably decided to call it a night. or see what was going on in the puppy bowl.
Oh, puppy bowl. I mean, yeah, because I know a lot of people who they were just like, after the halftime show, it's like, well, this is it. I'm going to go to sleep. Like, I pretty much know the score. And if you decided to watch, it definitely gave you a run for your money all the way up till the end. It was definitely, 49ers kind of came out of nowhere and really mm-hmm. kind of made it a tight race again. And in the end, though, Ravens won. And I think it was a really big thing for them, you know. Of course, any team to win the Super Bowl.
Right. And then... how about that halftime show?
That was a really good halftime show.
I mean,
over the last few years, it's been very difficult, especially post Janet Jackson, to really have. Obviously, I understand working in a business where the FCC is, you know, it's very important to, you know.
Less than a minute.
Yeah. I definitely would. I mean, these last few shows have been a little bit lacking, you know, and it was really good to have a show where Beyonce is coming out. It's just a really strong performance. The projections were just amazing. The music was awesome. It was really cool to kind of have this mini Destiny's Child reunion mm-hmm. up on stage, which is something that people definitely wanted to see. And overall, just was a really strong, wonderful performance. That we hadn't really seen it, and this was obviously after an amazing halftime or sorry pregame show. I hear Justin Timberlake and Alicia Keys did a great job. Jennifer Hudson sang with the Sandy Hook children. Just really good, amazing, and strong musical performances all around.
I agree. And now it is 9:50. We teased it on the. In the show's opening that we're going to give away a Gertz Berry gift card for the person who could go on our Facebook page and answer the trivia question that I am posting right now. And so
post.
It is up.
Post.
If you go to facebook.com/thesandspur, you'll find our question. What was Rollins' official college color? And by that,
Original
college color. I'm updating it as we speak. Original. I could spell that right. And currently, of course, it is blue and gold.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Beautiful colors.
Yes.
Majestic in their glory.
Which is probably meant to mimic the logo of the sun going over Lake Virginia.
Over the horizon. I mean, our motto is Fiat Lux, let there be light. And
we got that lake, too.
We got that wonderful lake. So, yeah. So, what? You know, it's very interesting. So when I found out, I was quite amazed. It's like I had no idea.
Yeah. The original color. It's neither blue nor gold.
Neither. That is your big hint. It is neither blue
nor...
Nor gold.
Key words.
Key.
And so, again, that website, facebook.com/thesandspur, is where you will find that. And so, as we await that, I will begin to read you what was written in the inaugural issue of the Sandspur way back in 1894. The answer is in this passage. However, let's see if you can guess it before I get to that part. So, the article, The College Color. The complaining whispers which the writer has heard for the past 5 years in regard to the college color have at last increased till they are quite audible and demand interpretation. We are aware that to some it will seem like treading on sacred ground to speak against our color, but if the complaints are likely to go on, it seems to us that the sooner a change is made, the better. It is said that the rose pink, which was selected and which Wanamaker promised to keep in stock for us, is not the color which we now use, and that the original color cannot be procured, a good reason for changing it. We hold the thought, aspirations, and plans of the college pioneers as indeed sacred. We think that this is one matter which demands a change. One of the first graduates with whom we have consulted agrees with us that a change of color could be made to advantage. It is the first place a college color, like its motto, should be made typical of the institution which it represents. That is, typical of the aspirations and ideals which the college is supposed to cherish. Colors express character. One would not use pale blue to suggest strength, nor dark red to express delicacy. Pale colors in general are not suggestive of strength, though some have a good deal of character through associations. For instance, yellow as the color nearest allied to light and emblematic of the sun, which is a creative power, has a force and value which no other pale color has. The one strong objection to rose pink is that it is felt to be inadequate to express dignity, strength, and stability. It is a very pretty color for girls' evening dresses, or worsted shoes and sacks for young babies, but we feel indeed that something with deeper meaning is demanded for the purpose under consideration. While we do not wish to adopt the crimson of Harvard, nor the orange and black of Princeton, nor the colors of any prominent college, we think we should be not too fearful of having a color which has already been chosen. Whether we know of it or not, there is little chance that a color can be found which has not already been selected by one of the colleges of our land. We have considered a great many colors, and nothing better than the following has come to mind. For a single color, maroon has a richness and suggests depth and strength. A charming combination of colors are royal blue and gold, each color giving force to the other by contrast. A beautiful college pin could be designed of gold letters on an enamel background of royal blue, which is very deep and rich, almost merging into purple. Let the royal blue suggest kingship, power, and the highest and deepest in character aims, and let the gold mean to us unchanging value and real, substantial worth. While we know that the settlement of this subject is not for us, and while we would not dream of insisting on our choice, we hope for a fair consideration of this subject by all interested, and that someday a color or colors will be found that will meet the wishes of all. And do we have a winner? Do we ever? Hey, where'd that post go?
That
I did see a name pop up on it. But where, oh where, did our contest post go? Well, we'll settle this over the internet. But I did see that at least one person did answer correctly. And I will not share the name in case that is, in fact, not the winner. But I did see that it was shared. And that Gertzberry gift card will be yours upon our contacting you once we get off the air.
Yes, it would be wonderful.
And so we'll have contests in the future.
Yes, and they will be fun and as magical, if not more so, than this one.
If not more so.
Yes.
We do have an updated website to share.
Yes. If you go to this website, http://annieinthetropics.tk, that is the dramaturgical website for Anna in the Tropics that Dr. Mobley was talking about. That is where you can go and find a lot of background information, not only on the show, but see pictures of the cast. And that's where you can go to become more informed, to know kind of the background of Anna in the Tropics and kind of learn a little bit about the process and whatnot. So definitely check that out. I just checked it out now while through the interview, and it was really, really cool. So I definitely would suggest looking at it.
Absolutely. And some of the music you heard on today's program was Cuban Pete by Desi Arnaz.
Ah, Desi Arnaz. I love Lucy, and I love Desi.
We also heard a piece from The Power and the Glory, the original music and voices of NFL films. I believe the song we heard was The Equalizer.
Equalizer.
Equalizer. That Sam Spence created song. And next week will be our Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day, episode. Yes. We'll be talking about love and all that jazz. I mean, right now, 10 days away from Valentine's Day. By next Monday, we'll be, what, three, four days?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, so it'll be a good episode. Hopefully we'll just be talking about all the little aspects of it. There's going to be an article about Valentine's Day in the New Sanspur coming out on Valentine's Day.
Whoa.
So that, I mean, of course we had to talk about it at least to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Is that your article?
Actually, that will be my article.
Preview it for us briefly.
Yes. So the article will be talking about unrequited love through the lens of Charlie Brown and the Peanuts universe. So it'll be very interesting, just kind of my two cents and kind of looking at this timeless old comic and how it has dealt with love over the last 30 or so years.
Very 40, cool.
50 years.
And as we wind down, please know that you may also submit articles if you're a student of Rollins College to submit at thesanspur.org. There's also an article assignment meeting happening tonight from 6 to 6:30 on the fifth floor of the Mills Memorial Building that all are welcome to attend. And any other inquiries may also be submitted to submit at thesanspur.org.
Great.
And that will bring us to the end of hour two.
Yes.
Overall.
Overall, we want to thank all of our guests, Dr.
Yes.
David Charles, Dr. Jessica Mobley, Alexa Gordon, Scott Novak, and Matt Hendry. Thank you all so much for coming, and we hope you all enjoyed today's show. From Amir Sadeh and Greg Golden, we are out.
Have a great week.